Thank you. Welcome back. The hits keep coming. This is session four, Regulating Participation, and it's again my honor to introduce our two panelists. First, Julie Cohen is professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center. She teaches and writes about intellectual property law and information privacy law, with a particular focus on digital works and on the intersection of copyright, privacy rights, and information architectures. She is the author of Configuring the Network Self, Law, Code, and the Play of Everyday Practice, 2012, and a co-author of Copyright in a Global Information Economy, 2010. Professor Cohen is a member of the advisory boards of the Electronic Privacy Information Center and Public Knowledge, and her talk today will be entitled The Surveillance Innovation Complex, The Irony of the Participatory Turn. Our second speaker will be Birgitta Jónsdóttir, who comes to us from Alting, Iceland, where she is a poetician and activist, currently serving as a member of the Icelandic Parliament for the Pirate Party, of which she is one of the founders. She is also a founder and chairperson of the International Modern Media Institute, better known as IMI, and was the chief sponsor of the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, a parliamentary proposal that tasked the government to make Iceland a safe haven for freedom of information, expression, and speech. Unanimously accepted in 2010, the proposal is now in the process of being drafted into law. And her paper today will be entitled Innovation in 21st Century Lawmaking. Please join me in welcoming Julie Cohen.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for having me here. It's lovely to come to Canada, as always, and this has been a fabulous event so far, so my aspiration is just to continue in that vein, I hope. I want to contextualize a little bit, so what you're about to hear is a piece of a larger project, and the project deals with how contests over the regulation of information are changing the nature of law and legal institutions. There's often a perception, particularly among legal people, that the law is kind of an immovable object, but what I'm exploring in this project is how law steps into these contests and becomes part of the contest, so law is itself changed. And this piece of the project deals with the reshaping of the relationship between surveillance and the administrative state. And it's useful, I think, to start in terms of theory by situating my inquiry within the context of kind of an anxiety that's become very palpable among scholars that study surveillance about how surveillance is to be framed and perhaps reframed in the information era. So for a very long time, I think the frame was the frame that you see on your left. The frame of surveillance is domination, top-down, state-oriented, and kind of the uber-text was discipline and punish, although one could have a dispute about what exactly that means. Is it a visual metaphor that has the upper hand, or is it statistical normalization, or is it something else? That framing has been challenged by what you see on your right. The notion of surveillance as participation and profit, consisting of multi-directional flows of information, it becomes lightened, but it's a corporatized form of surveillance, LITE. And the Uber text, to some extent, I think, is becoming Deleuze's postscript on control societies, although, again, there's some debate that one could have about what exactly that text means. And then that reframing, in turn, is itself being challenged by the view that says one must take into account surveillance as pleasure and as play. Within the participatory condition, which is, of course, why we're all here. And what I'd like to submit to you, I think, so I like the play frame in some respects, and there's enormous value to be talking about the influence of play on our understanding of how surveillance is done and how the modalities by which it governs our conduct. But play and concepts of play and participation are also, I think, reframing, again, the way surveillance is governed. The governance paradigm implicit in this right-hand column is, again, sort of state domination, or the left-hand column, excuse me. And then as you move to the right, the question sort of morphs into a question about the extent of the state's refusal or perhaps inability to effectively regulate data sharing. So what I want to argue to you today is that as we expand our understanding of surveillance to take account of pleasure and play, in fact, what we're seeing is that concepts of play are being deployed to reposition surveillance as light and nimble and normatively untouchable by the administrative state as inherently progressive. And so what I want to do then is move beyond the kind of the frame that emerged from the merging of these first two columns, which has been kind of the sort of heavy-handed industrial notion of a surveillance industrial complex to the notion of a surveillance innovation complex. And more particularly, what I want to do is work through a reframing of surveillance around modes of participation that occurs along three different dimensions, and each of these dimensions is kind of a dialectical relationship between the two halves, and in sum, then we have a dynamic that gives rise to what I call the surveillance innovation complex, and only part of it is really about play. The other two dimensions bring in different ways of talking about how we want to think about and evaluate participation. So first of all, playing and being played. It's been pointed out by a variety of really talented people that that as play becomes incorporated into surveillance dynamics, play itself changes. We hear talk now about the gamification of work and the gamification of surveillance. There is an absolutely wonderful paper in this most recent issue of Surveillance in Society by someone named Jennifer Whitson, who might even be here because she's at Concordia, about how surveillance theorists ought to understand gamification, and I commend it to you. Gamification habituates the players to playing within systems of surveillance. And as games become apps, apps not only habituate us to games, but habituate us to convenience, and apps bury the functionality behind surveillance and surveillance infrastructures to an extent that makes it difficult to discern. And then the third piece of the changing nature of play is its rationalization within systems of analytics that enable the very intensive and thoroughly data-based quantification of behavior in ways, again, that tend to bury kind of the normative frameworks and the constructs that are driving the construction of the interfaces. The cumulative effect of this is to construct the subject as a gamer, and as a gamer within systems of surveillance. And of course, that needs to factor in then to how we understand power within systems of surveillance. So if you think back to that Deleuzian column, what seems to be most apt as a reading of that is control as it becomes modulation. So there's this wonderful book called The Filter Bubble by American author Eli Pariser about how each person is increasingly moving within an information environment that is modulated, that is tailored to that person's predilections. It's sort of the inverse of the personal becoming political. Now the political is becoming personal. Things are served up on a very fine-grained and personalized and tailored level. And that being the case, it's useful, I think, to think about it in terms of the what this pair of women from I'm forgetting whether it's Sweden or Norway, are calling the pastoral power of technology. The gamified technology environment is leading us gently. It's not really about domination, but about the care of the self, and yet under conditions in which we're alienated from the bones of the technology, the algorithms that are doing the shaping. A third strand, I think, that becomes useful for thinking about the power relation here is the notion of the crowd versus the notion of the multitude. The crowd being the sort of the more sheep-like incarnation of the two, the body of people that are sort of herded this way and that, versus the multitude, which connotes a richer conception of agency. So in this case, when one thinks about the relationship between play and surveillance, the dialectic between playing and being played revolves around power and power over flows of information. And so far, I suspect I haven't said anything that will be very surprising to a room full of media scholars. But now I want to go to the second dimension or the second dialectical relationship that I think has to inform our understanding of the relationship between surveillance and play. And that's the dialectic between crowdsourcing on the one hand and crowds as resources on the other. So what we are seeing in this space of gamifying and appifying surveillance is really an astonishing flowering of open development mechanisms. Open development, I'm using it in the sense in which it migrated initially from the open source software movement to other contexts. And the context that I have in mind now is open data, right? So we're seeing the very conscious creation of ecosystems, sometimes also characterized by open code, but definitely characterized by open data, in which the development of apps for gamification of the care of the self can occur. And this movement then harnesses the intellectual and cultural cachet of sort of alternativeness that I think all the open movements have taken on, and yet they're very consciously state-directed and private sector-directed. So if you look at the United States, President Obama signed the Open Government Directive directing the use of open development processes to the greatest extent possible. And every year now in Washington, the Health and Human Services Department sponsors this thing called the Health Data Palooza, which is supposed to bring app and game designers together with health people to develop apps for health data, which has the health privacy people in fits every year because it's you can imagine why, right? And then there's a lawsuit ongoing in Colorado over this thing called InBloom, which is an app for education. And within Colorado, the folks who run the public education system contracted with this entity to dump into its apps all of the data about school children in the public school system and kind of appify for teachers ways to record their progress and their behavioral issues. And there's some parents who don't think that's such a good idea. But it's not just a question of developed countries or the West. So now take India, where the government has put in place the development of a uniform biometric ID, and the pitch is that this will bring into the world of identification and thus into the world of eligibility for public benefits the very poor who don't have access to those benefits and don't have access to identification and so on and so forth. But if you talk to activists on the ground there who are pushing back against UID, what you find is actually a lot of the same thing I've just described as going on in the States. A lot of talk about apps for health and open development and not so much of a good handle on who's getting access to these pools of data. Similar experiments with biometric authentication underway in various places in Latin America and Mexico and Argentina. I'm trying to get around the language issue and dig into that more, but I wonder whether I may discover the same thing going on there. And so I think that a useful way to think about this is in terms of a framing of what we might now call the biopolitical public domain. And in terms of an ongoing great transformation, so there's a wonderful book that I like a lot by Carl Polanyi, A History of the Transformation from Agrarianism to Industrialism. And he talks about it in terms of creating perceived dictates to commodify resources, and the resources that needed to be commodified were land, labor, and money to serve the needs of industrialization. But he calls them fictitious commodities. Why fictitious? Well, they can't any of them really be commodified without causing immense dislocation and suffering. And ultimately, the fights over that led to things like the first working hour and minimum wages legislation. This was in England. If you think about or posit that we're sitting in the middle of another great transformation, right, to this state that Manuel Castells has evocatively named the era of informational capitalism, we see, or we could posit, that different resources are required. Information, attention, and so on, and this kind of need, I think, enables us to re-theorize surveillance as bioprospecting, right? The function creating and framing a biopolitical public domain is to constitute a pool of resources that is there for the taking. That's what a public domain is. It's a pool of resources that law says isn't itself owned by anybody, and thus anybody can take from it. And the harnessing of the intellectual cachet of the open development movements is very nice, but it fits neatly into this story as kind of a pre-commodification stage in what eventually will become full-on commodification as resources are appropriated from the public domain. Okay, the second dialectical relationship that I think we have to consider as we kind of scope out the emerging and changing relationship between surveillance and play. And it's a dialectic that revolves now not around power over information flows per se, but about power over surplus extraction, power to engage with information flows in a process of surplus extraction. And that leads to then the third dialectic, or the third relation, which brings in the question of how, other than by constituting a new biopolitical public domain, law comes to this enterprise. How does law regulate here? And what we are seeing, I think, at least certainly within the U.S. regulatory process, is that the cachet of openness, again, is being recruited and linked to various neoliberal or libertarian themes to produce a regulatory discourse that privileges surveillance and seeks to place it really beyond the reach of government. The first of, and I have two slides on this, so the first one has to do with the rhetorics within which this is framed. There is a strand of the rhetoric that says that the emerging practices of surveillance should be thought about in terms of consumers exercising freedom of choice in so-called information privacy markets. And of course, that's really weirdly oxymoronic because ordinarily, if you think about a market for something, like a market for cars are produced and cars are sold, right? A market for information privacy leads to less information privacy. So it's odd, but there you have it. It's definitely there in the rhetoric. The second strand has to do with information processing as autonomous innovation. And of course, if you have any background in STS and you see that word, all your little sensors prick up, because we've been told for a very, very long time that certainly technology is not autonomous, something that played a very substantial role in fostering an awareness that technology is not autonomous was diffusion studies, which tend to show, as I'm sure you all know, that diffusion and innovation are very contingent, right? Things get out there and then there become contests between various stakeholders and interest groups and constituencies about what they want the technology to do, and what you get at the end is a very contingent thing. And yet this contingency has been repackaged as autonomy once it hits kind of the neoliberal matrix in the following way, right? So where does diffusion happen? In markets. What are markets? Markets, according to neoclassical economic theory, are autonomous and rational, right? So in fact, technology may not be autonomous, but innovation is. Innovation is autonomous, and it deserves, therefore, to be privileged. And when Google or the Direct Marketing Association or whoever goes into the FCC or FTC to lobby against more restrictive data processing regulations, one sees rhetoric about innovation and about consumer data processing as innovation. And then the third frame, which is just weirdly U.S.-centric, is this notion that our First Amendment is capacious enough to protect information processing as an exercise of expressive liberty, which is just so weird. I'm not going to say anything else about it. Thank you. What happens to these rhetorics? They don't just kind of swirl around in the air. They cash out, I think, in a very concrete way. And to explain where I think I'm going with this, it's useful to reach back to Polanyi and to the concept of a great transformation. So what does the administrative state in the era of informational capitalism look like? I would argue we don't know that yet. And what we're engaged in right now is a contest to recraft the administrative state, right, to determine what the administrative state is going to look like. And what we have is we have the administrative state as it developed out of the industrial era. And again, this part of the talk is a little U.S.-centric because that's what I know. But if you look at our administrative state, it's divided along industrial divisions of authority, right? We have health, and we have communications, and we have trade, and we have environment, and we have education. And crucially, within each of these areas, how one treats information is really unsettled, right? So typically, in litigation involving something one of these agencies has done, there will be some discussion about do they have jurisdiction to regulate informational activities, and there is a position that has evolved that the agency has ancillary jurisdiction over some information activities as they relate to its core mission. But that's really kind of not the same thing as confronting the effects of information and information processing activities more directly. And that's a byproduct of the way that information has been viewed for a long time within kind of the neoliberal matrix or the industrial era framework for the administrative state, which is that information facilitates markets much more than it distorts them. And so the role of the administrative state is kind of to undo distortions that arise. Then we have kind of this toxic mix of notions of economic liberty fused with expressive liberty whenever there's an attempt to kind of regulate information processing activities more directly. And the way that is starting to cash out, I think, is that we get to a position where it is argued with great seriousness that I've hyphenated it, but informational innovation is and ought to be doubly exempt from regulatory oversight. And among other things, therefore, there's no role or need for what one might call a precautionary principle in the realm of information activities. The precautionary principle is what, for example, puts the onus on people who are messing with the water supply or the food chain to demonstrate an absence of harmful effects. It's well understood in the domain of regulations that have to do with health and the environment. It's typically sort of taken taken for granted, not interrogated at all, that one would not need a precautionary principle in the domain of information processing. And I think that is in no small part due to this emerging surveillance innovation complex, which has not necessarily as a conspiracy, but as its effect, the effect of pushing regulation to the margin, right? So one possible outcome in terms of what does the administrative state look like in the age of informational capitalism is it is pushed to the margin, right? It is marginalized. It is sort of negated in terms of a core capability to intervene in some of the more harmful aspects of the activities that are going on. you know, I think that's from a regulatory perspective a question that needs to be confronted. I think in terms of understanding the role of surveillance within this emerging system and the way that the dialogue between law and surveillance is now being reshaped, it's useful then to add another column which surveillance is conceived fundamentally as biopolitics, as transformative, and one of its sort of regulatory modalities is a negation of accountability. And then I think that the discussion that needs to be had is okay. Well, so is that what we really want our administrative state to look like in the information age? And if not, what do we want it to look like instead? Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. And